Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Derailed Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Fred.
Fred, thank you for, well, making time to be here. Thank you for joining me from your lounge to your kitchen.
I'm always happy to be in my own home.
Yeah, it's very nice of you. I do appreciate it. Yeah, it is hot.
It is very hot in Joburg.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of temperatures people who listen to this get to. I suppose some of the guys from the US get some pretty hardcore temperatures.
Yeah, although it's more wintry there now while we're headed into summer. So
how hot does Europe? No, Europe gets hot, man. I'm just thinking Italy and stuff can get pretty brutal, actually.
Yeah, no, it can.
Yeah, so what are you on today? Like 35 degrees?
Something like that. Celsius, yeah.
What's that in freedom units?
95.
Okay.
Yeah, 95 Fahrenheit.
I know that in America, 100 is really hot. So we're close to the really hot range.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Joburg can get pretty hot in the summer, but it normally rains like in the evenings and stuff.
Yeah, but we haven't had proper rain yet.
Yeah, so that's like the hot conversation topic around Joburg at the moment. Like every time you talk to people, it's just like, yo, it's hot, eh?
We really need rain.
Yeah, and they'll come back and you're like, oh, we just need it to rain. Like, yo, man. Yes.
But we do because it's so dusty. It's like so dusty.
It's true. Everywhere. But it's so funny. I must have the same conversation like 6 times a day about where the rain is. Yeah. What's happening with the rain.
Yeah.
So just we wanted to mention after we record this episode, we're actually going to record another one right afterwards, which is going to kind of be like a bonus episode. So just a heads up, Fred's not here next week. So we just thought we'll just do kind of like a bonus episode. So no mail, no like feedback stuff, and probably not really any 18XX stuff. I think we said we were just going to do kind of like a chilled episode. We're going to talk a little bit about ourselves, some of our other interests, hobbies, stuff like that.
Yes.
Kind of just more about us, I suppose.
Yeah.
So it's fully a bonus episode in the sense that you can really skip it.
You can skip it. So we probably won't even number it.
Yeah, no, I don't think we'll
just call it a bonus 01 or something.
Yeah, so it won't really be sort of an 18XX episode. So, but we wanted to put something out there because we're trying to stick to our weekly schedule as much as we can.
Yes.
But yeah, we've been a bit short on plays lately, hey?
Yeah, but hopefully we'll get a play in this week.
Yeah, I think we'll get a play in this week and probably a play in next week as well. So next time we record, we'll probably have a lot to talk about, which will be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a dry spell for us in 18XX, but we're very keen to.
Yeah.
Well, I'm feeling like I need to
push some shares
around.
We did start an online game with some of our Discord Patreon members.
Yes.
In 1830. So that's still in the early stages.
Yeah. So, we must definitely actually chat about that. There's actually a few intersections of 1830 we want to chat about. I think we'll talk about that when we get to the mail, maybe, and we can integrate some of that stuff.
Okay.
But we just wanted to say thanks to the Patreon people. It's been really, really awesome. We've had a lot of people sign up, and I think for me, it's been really fun having people join the Discord server and kind of growing a little bit of a community there. I've really enjoyed the conversations there.
Yes.
It's been quite active, which has been really, really cool.
Yeah, very cool.
Very cool to hear about what people are playing and to hear people's thoughts on different games. And just being able to chat to some of the listeners and stuff has been really, really cool. So really enjoyed that. We just quickly wanted to give a shout out to all the new Patreons.
Since last week,
yeah. So we have Howell Carver, Dave Berry, who we got an email from. He was the designer of 18GB. Shazner, cool name. Jesper Carlson, Kyle Curlett, Benjamin Dirks, and Gabe. I think that's Gabe Newell. He's just being undercover. Gabe, if you're listening, I'm still waiting for Half-Life 3. Make it happen, Gabe. Make it happen. So thanks so much, guys. We really, really, really appreciate it a lot.
Yes, absolutely.
Very cool. Very cool that there's some people out there who actually think that what you're doing has enough value to support it on Patreon. So yeah, it's been really, really cool.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention before we head to the mail room?
No, let's get to the mail.
Sweet.
That right there is the mail. Now let's talk about the mail. Can we talk about the mail, please, Mac? I'm dying to talk about the mail with you all day, okay?
So I just wanted to start with a couple of short ones. We got a message from one of our Swedish listeners. I like the Swedes, eh? We get a lot of Swedish people emailing us. You guys are cool. I have no idea how to pronounce your name. I'm going to go with, what does it mean when there's two dots over the O, though?
Let me see.
Fred, you're a Swedish expert. Just check the signature there.
I would not say I'm an expert at all.
Yeah, I feel like it's like an Afrikaans thing.
It's almost like a...
You guys put some dots over your letters.
I think
sometimes.
It's like an O or something, but yeah. I'm not sure.
Oyan?
Oyan, yeah.
We're going with Oyan.
That's a good...
If we screw that up horribly, it's Fred's fault. yeah, so Oyan says, he says, thanks for a very good podcast. Thanks for saying nice things. Yeah, he says, appreciates our perspective as noobs to season train gamers. I'm not sure if we're at that second part just yet, but yeah, hopefully soon. Yeah, so Oyan says he's actually designing an 18XX set in Sweden, which is kind of a hobby project of his. So he said that he'd love it if we would take a look and give him some feedback. I don't think we'd be very good at giving feedback, but he did mention that no non-native English speaker has read the rules yet. So I've just seen your email now, Oyan, so I'll definitely have a look. And yeah, I'll write back to you.
Are there some PNP files in there?
Yes, right? Yeah. There's some files there. So I'm keen to have a look. So we can have a look at that. And I'll send you a proper email back. But yeah, thanks for getting in touch.
And might help with some of the English stuff if I spot anything.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think probably most importantly is if it's clear to us what it is you're trying to say.
Yeah.
If we understand what rule you kind of mean by that, right? Yeah. So I have a kind of funny email from a guy called Mark. He said he's really been enjoying the show, especially the South African segments. Hey. So he said a few weeks ago, you had an email from a listener whose name is Dan, who lives about 45 minutes from Detroit, Michigan. I also live in this radius. Would you be able to forward this message to Dan in case we can meet up to play?
Well, that's awesome.
I think it would be hilarious if I can meet a local player through a South African podcast.
That's great. We can matchmake some 18XX players.
Yeah, which is hilarious. I think this will be a new service we provide. So if anyone has a lost connection or... Yeah.
I think you should do that. Send Dan Mark's email
address. Oh, I definitely
something.
Will. Yeah.
So where is Mark located? 45
minutes from Detroit.
As well.
Dan said he was as well. So
so we don't know which direction from Detroit.
No, but no.
They could be, I mean, max 90 minutes away.
GPS coordinates, but...
But max, they're 90 minutes away from each other. So that's still
true.
Probably feasible.
I'd drive 90 minutes for an 18XX game.
Yeah. Once a month over a weekend or something, for sure.
100%. Yeah. So I got a kick out of that. So Mark, I'll definitely send your email to Dan.
Dan and Mark, we want to be invited to the wedding.
Exactly. So he said keep up the good work. By the way, the Herald on Games podcast recently did an interview with the owner of Grand Trunk Games, who is launching a Kickstarter for an 1861-1867 re-release. Yeah, so I've already backed that Kickstarter.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah. So we will eventually be playing that.
Awesome.
But in case anyone doesn't know, it's up on Kickstarter at the moment. It's basically two games in one box. The guy he's referring to is Joshua Starr, who also sent us an email, which we'll get to in a second. Really, really recommend everyone check that out. It looks like a really good Kickstarter. I really like what he's done with the box. So if you sort of flip it around, it says it looks like a box cover on the one side and a box cover on the other side for each of the two games. A really cool design.
So you can put it on your shelf, whichever one you want to.
Yes, exactly.
Have visible, yeah.
So the one is sort of like a... I guess you could say like a second edition of the other in a way.
Okay.
As far as I understand it. So 1867 is by the same designer as 61. Came out some amount of years after that one. Was some kind of updated stuff. And I think a pretty different feeling game, but sort of a similar idea behind it. So yeah, it's got kind of some double-sided components and things like that. So you can choose which game you want to play essentially. And they play on different maps as well.
Okay.
But what I noticed, which I thought was really affordable, was I think the price point was $60, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, effectively two 18XXs.
Yeah, I think that's really awesome. And we will always support any attempts at bringing 18XX to the mainstream. And I think stuff like that, if we can show that support, it's only going to grow the genre, it's going to grow the whole industry around it. So if you have $60 to spare, I really recommend checking that out.
And can we go on a bit of a Kickstarter route? Because I think this is the kind of thing that Kickstarter is meant for.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
Because like people like CMON Games doing Kickstarters and things, I think, are just ridiculous. They absolutely have the money to just self-publish, but they kind of use the Kickstarter for the hype behind it and everything, and I don't like that. So I think this kind of thing where you have a smaller market and you need to be able to raise the money before you can start production is exactly what Kickstarter is for. So,
yeah, absolutely, in the spirit of Kickstarter rather than as a kind of a pre-order portal.
Or as a marketing tool.
CMON have kind of perfected that whole FOMO thing where they kind of want you to feel like you're going to miss out on a bunch of cool stuff.
Yeah, all the exclusives, which are nonsense. I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I agree with you. I hate what Kickstarter has become for board games, and I love to see stuff like this, which is literally someone basically starting their own publishing company saying, I want to bring 18xx to the mainstream, and Kickstarter is the perfect way to do that, because it's a huge risk to self-publish, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 units of these games and make them sit in a warehouse, and
you can if you don't know you'll be able to sell them. Then
Can do the you can do the 18xx bankruptcy in real life with that. Yeah. So I think this is perfect reason for Kickstarter to exist, and I think what in the spirit of Kickstarter it's meant to be.
Yes.
So yeah, definitely go check that out, guys. I really, really recommend it. Also, some stuff about the games that I've read, which sounds cool, is that they're quite short playing.
Okay.
Which I like. Fairly operational in nature, if that's kind of your thing. So less focus on like what we always call like stock market shenanigans or whatever. And more focused on running good companies, manipulating the map and stuff like that. I must say I myself am probably like a stock market shenanigans kind of person, but I've developed a real appreciation for the other half of 18xx games. And I will never be bored playing an 18xx. So and I'm keen, because apparently you can get them done in 2 to 3 hours as well, which is perfect for us. So
We do most of our 18xx on school nights. So
exactly. So I'm quite excited for that as well. So like I say, I've already backed it, and looking forward to it.
Great.
Cool. So I think that Joshua sent us quite a long email, which is quite cool, and we had some thoughts on this as well. So our last episode, we spoke a lot about the 1830 private auction, and there's some stuff that's kind of, I think, worth revisiting around that. So Joshua sent us some good points on that as well. So some things to kind of consider, and I think it's definitely worth discussing as sort of an extension of the last episode as well.
Okay.
So the first thing he mentioned is that I reference his article in terms of that trick for avoiding the B&O, that sort of simple shortcut kind of thing. So he was saying that one thing he kind of neglected was the issue of priority deal and if people are tied in revenue.
Right.
So the example he uses, what happens if people in a four-player game, the revenues are split 15, 15, 20, and 25? So this idea is that there's that threshold of revenue that you want to be under or above. Both those players on 15 are below it. But who buys the B&O?
Right.
So what he said in theory is that it's actually the player second to act of those two players that is forced to buy it. Because if I'm the first player, I get to just pass and look at you and say, well,
it's up to you now.
It's up to you now.
Are you willing to lose more money, or are you going to buy it?
Exactly. Yeah. If you pass, the other guys are going to pass and we're going to go to another R. So you can kind of end up in this weird stalemate.
Yes. Yeah.
And something that he pointed out is that from like a game theory perspective, how it would work. But in reality, someone could just be like, screw you, I'm going to hold firm and not buy it. Or
you have to know that the second player understands the situation he's in.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he's going to pass and then now you're losing
out. Well, that's the other big thing, right? That player may not have a clue and they just think, I'm not going to buy it, I'm going to wait for this dude to buy it.
Yeah.
You can never really predict how people are going to act. And sometimes there's an optimal way to play, and sometimes people don't want to play that way or don't know what that play is. And that's what's interesting about these games, is you have to constantly react.
Or they know and they just want to play chicken with you.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Some people will literally just be like, I know what you're doing and I'm actually not going to stand for it. You know, which is kind of almost like, we often reference poker on the show, but kind of like a poker thing, right? Where someone will aggressively defend their blinds or something like that, because in future rounds, they don't want you to think that you can pick on them.
Yeah,
so like I can imagine a group that plays 1830 a lot and they think, no, I'm not going to buy it. I'll sacrifice this game and maybe I'll put myself a little bit behind. But in the future, you're not going to think you can get away with making me do it just because I'm second.
Yes.
So I guess there's that to consider as
well. It is, yeah, for sure.
So the next thing Joshua asked us, and this is a thought-provoking question rather than telling us a fact. But he says, what do you think is the purpose of the private auction? How would it change the game if it did not exist? In my opinion, that is very key to understanding what separates 1830 from all of its clones. So you had some thoughts on this, I think, because we were discussing it before we started recording.
Yeah, so I didn't have a lot of time to give it thought, but the one thing I thought was that it could potentially kind of negate, in a way, the first player advantage. Because in 18xx, you draw four seats, you effectively draw four priority deal.
Right.
And that is theoretically an advantage. And the way the private companies shake out can take away some of that advantage that the random first player has. So through your skill in the private auction, you can take away the advantage someone got who randomly got the first player thing. And another thing is it's almost kind of like what we call variable or player powers in other board games. Because if those privates didn't exist, every single player in that game is exactly the same, effectively. But the privates kind of give each player a different power in a way, or a different ability or something like that as well.
Yeah, you're essentially starting from different positions.
Mm.
Otherwise, the optimal play or whatever would be totally figured out.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because we kind of discussed optimal play around the auction, but with all these player-driven games, that's not necessarily the case.
Yes.
Things are worth about as much as people are willing to pay for them a lot of the time.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's never entirely certain. In terms of 1830 specifically, I think it's warped a little bit by the one private being so powerful, potentially. Mm. I think that sets it apart from some others. We played a lot of 89. I don't feel like in 89 there's a private that has to be so aggressively defended.
Right.
As well.
Yeah. But, and I must say, after our last episode, we've since started the online game with some of our patrons of 1830. And I now find that private auction a lot more interesting after us having discussed some strategy about it.
So an interesting scenario has come up in that game that we said we should probably talk about. So from my perspective, I decided to bid on the CNA and I bid something like 190 or something.
Yeah,
something quite fairly kind of large, right? Just to kind of see what would happen. And then it came back to me and no one had outbid me on it yet. And I wasn't really sure what to do.
Well, so I was priority deal and I just put a bid in of one, what does it sell for? 160 or 170.
Yeah.
So I just put in a bid of 175, basically just $5 more than the face value, just to be in the bidding when it comes around to that company. So I didn't set the price that I'm actually willing to pay for it. Someone else put in a bid, and then you put in a bid of 190.
Yeah.
Someone else put in a bid after you, I think, of 200. Is that right?
Yeah, so that was before it came back to me. So when it came back to me, my bid on that was the highest, and I had the option to now bid on something else.
Right.
So I wasn't sure what to do because I was worried about a scenario in which I bid on something else and I've almost spent too much cash.
Mm.
So that let's say I won the thing I bid on and I won that one. And then I couldn't float anything in the first stock round. How bad would that be for me?
Mm.
Potentially, I wasn't really sure. So I ended up just kind of passing just to kind of see what happens, which turned out to probably be a pretty terrible thing to do. And
I think you should put in a bid on another company. Well, the problem is in your situation there, most other companies already had bids on them. So if you bid on something, you might have to pay that price for it.
But what you're saying is that I could have bid lower.
You can't bid lower than a bid that's already there.
You can't bid lower than the current highest bid.
No.
Okay. So you can't do that.
So you have to bid higher by at least $5. So you might, if you put in a bid, you might end up paying it if you don't really want it. But I think you kind of have to be in the running for another company so that if someone buys that first company and kind of triggers the start of the closed bidding on the remaining privates, that you are in there as well and you have some options. Because you're now in this situation. So it came round back to me and I found this situation interesting because there was another company I wanted to do exactly that with. I wanted to just put a bid in there just to be in the running for it. Or I could buy the first company at face value and start the closed bidding. And that's what I did. I bought the first company at face value because you, and you're always my nemesis in these games, you only have a bid in on the CNA.
Yeah.
So, and there's now a bid higher than yours, which is 200. So I know you're either going to have to buy the CNA, you're going to have to pay a high price for it, or you'll have zero income and be on the hook to buy the BNO?
BNO, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that is something that I didn't really consider. And maybe I just clicked past a little bit too hastily. But I thought that was interesting.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to somewhat the power of buying that first private is that you get to dictate that flow.
Yes.
So by passing and not putting a bid on something else, I've now put myself in a situation where I don't have a lot of options.
Or you could have bought that first company at face value. Right. Then you at least have some income as well.
Yeah, or private to sell for some amount of money. Yeah, so it's quite interesting that because now in doing that, you triggered it. And you set the whole thing off with me with only one bid. So I'm only going to have option on CNA and Baltimore and Ohio, which no one has bid on.
So you either pay a lot for CNA or you're forced to buy BNO.
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll see how it shakes out.
And I wonder if that ferry company is the sort of the BNO of 89. The one that you can't sell to a corporation that just gives you income. The one that never closes. It gives you 30 and then once you're in permanence, it gives you 50. But it never closes.
Oh,
and
it can't be sold to that a corporation. That is a good one. That is a good one.
Yeah. See, I think that one might be bad.
You think that's the one you don't want?
I think that might be the one you don't want.
How so?
Which is funny because we like competed for it because we just wanted to try out the investor strategy when we played that game.
So that company is good if it's going to be a slow game. Because people, you're going to get so many ORs of income with that company. But if you're playing with, I think the more experienced the players are you're playing with, the worse that company becomes. Because typically, the more experienced the players are, the quicker the trains will go and the fewer ORs you will have and the less income you will get from
it. And I think the problem with it also is that it ties up a lot of your money early. So even though you get a return on your money, could your money be potentially be doing more for you if you had invested it in something else?
Yes.
You know, because then you can churn it, basically.
Yeah, no, I think you might be right. That might be the BNO of 89,
I think it might be, But for us, originally, we thought it was great.
Mm.
But we overestimated the value of revenue massively.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So something else that may be relevant for our game. How many people in our game? Is it 4 players or 5 players? Our Patreon game. I think it might be 5, actually.
I think it's 5.
Okay, so... Yeah, Josh says, CNA might be worth around 280 in a 4-player game, which is interesting because that is a huge amount, more than its face value of 160.
Yeah.
So basically, that would occur if you floated an SR2 and you were able to sell your pen share back and then kind of floated. So that can make it worth around 280 potentially in a 4-player game. So the bids can definitely get... pretty high.
Yeah.
So he says, CNA going for under 200 is not a death sentence if the player isn't familiar with playing that position. You can even let that player float the pen if others are aware of how strong it is. It's pretty amazing what you can do to a player's position if everyone is attacking it.
Mm.
Which is true. I mean, if everyone buys into that company and trashes the stock or works hard to mess up that route or whatever the case may be. Yeah, so you get into that metagame situation of this player has a very strong opening. We need to basically hinder it in some way.
Counteract it somehow, yeah.
This person is now a threat, Which I think is interesting in terms of, I don't know, I guess the concept of metagaming in 18XX, which I think is something we've touched on before, but how much of it is there? How much do you want to... not appear too strong in a way? Does appearing very strong put people against you and make them want to attack your position? Is that a thing you should even consider? Is there a bash the leader kind of thing happening potentially in 18XX? I'm not really sure. I've never given a lot of thought myself. I've always just tried to kind of do the best I can. Because I think what's interesting is that being in the best position often makes people want to kind of ride your coattails rather than attack you.
Yes.
They want to sort of invest in your companies or something like that, but that can put them in a vulnerable position as well.
Yeah.
So he's also saying the first private can be valuable because you can get it at face value and tip your revenue ahead of another player's, which is true, to help get you over that threshold to avoid getting the BNO. And as we've noted, valuable in sort of dictating the game flow as well when it suits you. He also asks here, what is the best possible run for a single 2-train in RR2? What is the worst possible run? How much do those runs pay you in dividends per share? So, yeah, I think that's something that's been commented on a lot and something that we commented on before with 89 and sort of the potential openings there is that it depends a lot on how much value you're going to get from that opening as well. I think it's very possible that your 2 trains in 1830 never run at all. Potentially, I'm not sure. That's possible in a lot of games. I don't know if it's possible in 1830, but I feel like it might be. Certainly, I'd say possible that you only kind of get to run them once. Yeah, I think a lot of games Marflow games I've played include an optional two train, one extra train that you can add if you want to make certain that your two trains will be able to run at least once. Right.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. And that is something that, yeah, I think early on we couldn't even process this idea that the trains could move that quickly. But we've since seen that at least come close to happening.
Yeah.
The last thing Josh stated was that if Champlain and St. Lawrence can lay a ditch to give Canadian Pacific a route, what does that mean for the player who holds it? I'm imagining what he's saying is that if you have that company but you don't float the Canadian Pacific, you can force the player who does to buy a train, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. The most important thing I imagine about that is that, yeah, if you can lay a town tile for them, you're forcing them to own a train, which is sometimes not what you want to be doing.
As the owner of the...
Yeah. You may want to wait for...
Yeah,
because especially if two trains only going to run once, it sort of serves you to potentially avoid those. But with anything in 18XX, I think 1830 as well, specifically perhaps even, there's so much that depends on what other players do.
Mm.
Yeah, because if no one is really incentivized to push the two trains or everyone's trying to hold back, then the person who has one or two of them is getting a lot more value out of them.
Yes.
Which then makes you want to buy them and force them and move the whole thing forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for that email, Josh. It was very, very cool. Yeah, definitely appreciate that. We always like getting feedback from old hands and veterans.
Yes.
Yeah. And things that make us think a little bit.
Absolutely.
So yeah, thanks for that. So I had an idea for a topic today. It ties into some of what we've been talking about. So I was reading some 18XX stuff, and I kind of stumbled across this topic on Board Game Geek about a taxonomy for 18XX games, which was basically how do we broadly categorize them. So oftentimes you hear people talking about this is a run good companies game. We often talk about like sort of engineering versus financial games.
Mm.
Like earlier, I just classified the 1861-67 as more of an engineering game, right?
Right.
So I think those are some of the things you broadly hear termed, and there were people having discussion around that. What is interesting about that to me, though, wasn't necessarily how do we broadly categorize games, but if there was a way in which when you're approaching a brand new 18XX game, you sit down to play it, are there kind of strategic shortcuts you could have in mind that would sort of give you an idea of what kind of game this was and what kind of game or strategy you need to kind of play, if that makes sense? So I'm going to try explain that a little bit more. So Dave Berry commented on this thread. He's the guy who sent us an email, one of our patrons and the designer of 18GB. So he said, what is perhaps one way to categorize games is what is it asking you to be as a player? Are you an investor, an entrepreneur, an operations manager, or a finance manager?
Okay.
So the way he defines those is basically an investor is a game in which you are, basically you have a portfolio of shares and your company's purpose is to sort of increase or decrease the value of those kinds of shares, right? So your broad focus is on your portfolio.
Okay.
So we haven't really played games that broadly fit into this category because one of the things he distinguishes here is that you're not especially liable with those companies. So you get games like 1860, which I've spoken about before. That's the one that's apparently very good at two player.
Mm-hmm.
But there you are not forced to buy a train if you have a route and can't run it.
Okay.
There's some kind of penalty, but it's not going to bankrupt you.
Right.
So that is kind of fits into that realm of investor.
Okay.
Where your companies are going to increase the value of your portfolio, but you're not stuck with big liabilities and things like that.
Yeah,
they're
less of a liability. Yeah.
The next one is one we're very familiar with, which is entrepreneur. So that's a kind of game where you are basically your fate is tied to that of your companies.
Mm.
You are someone who's like, I've got some money, I'm going to start a train company. Mm. And then if that fails, you fail along with it. So that's 1830, 1889, all those kinds of games, right?
Okay.
Where if you can't keep up with managing your company correctly, you go down with it.
Mm.
And then you get the operations manager, which are kind of those run good companies kind of games. So that would be something like 1846.
Yes.
Where you have liabilities in 1846, but your focus is largely on managing a company effectively and getting the most out of it.
Right, yeah.
And the last one is Finance Manager. These are games that have all kinds of financial stuff. These are games like 1817, which we also haven't had an opportunity to play. I think you had a failed attempt at trying to play that one online.
That's right, yeah.
So this is one that has stuff like short-term loans, mergers, acquiring companies, managing company accounts,
selling of shares.
Exactly, yeah. A lot of very financial kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So when I was reading this, I was thinking, I wonder if you could know going into a game what it was expecting of you, if you could kind of have some strategic shortcuts for how to play those games.
Right.
If that makes sense. So I think that could potentially be useful in identifying what kind of game is this, or what are the core tenets of this game? What are the sharp edges? What should I be looking out for?
Yeah.
And how much of that could you know going in?
Right.
I think some of that is based on reputation.
Yes, you can probably Google it pretty easily.
Yeah. So I think in terms of strategy, I find you can often find very little on specific titles.
Mm.
We are still kind of that niche, I feel, that you can't necessarily... Yeah, but I think you can get broad strokes oftentimes for what kind of a game it is. And I think that can potentially lend towards optimizing your strategy accordingly. Mm. So, yeah, the other person who commented in this thread was JC Lawrence, and he sort of spoke about some broad structural divides in games that would kind of help you narrow down which category you could fit it into.
Okay.
So, again, this was about categorizing games, but I was thinking, I wonder if we could sort of transplant this strategically into how we approach a game.
If you sit down at an 18xx you've never played before, what should your approach be?
Exactly. So, and this is where I felt like this was kind of interesting, the sort of tenets that JC identifies, I feel like, have application strategically.
Okay. Can I take a stab at something?
Yes. Yeah, go for it.
So the first thing I would look at is the stock market and what the stock market looks like. So if it's like an 1846 style 1D stock market, then it's probably more of a run good companies game, because there will be less stock shenanigans. Right. If it's more of a 2D stock market, like 1830 and those ones, then there might be more you can do in the stock market.
Yeah, and I'd say that's true. I think especially when you see those stock markets, like you say, that have all the different colored regions and all the things, you kind of look at that and you think this is going to be a game that there's a heavy focus on stock.
Right, yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting because I think some of the stuff you could identify in 46 very quickly is stuff like those triple jumps.
Yes.
Yeah. Once you hear triple jumps, that can change a lot of your views on things as well. So yeah. I'll get to that now because I think that comes up here.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm just going to go through some of the simple ones. So the first one is, how fast are the trains?
So how many of each one there are, kind of?
Yeah, and also what kind of jumps there are.
Right.
So in my opinion, if you look at 1846, I think this is a good example of a game that doesn't necessarily have fast trains relative to other games. I mean, you can burn through those trains pretty quickly, but you have stuff like the phasing out instead of immediately rusting, which is kind of a little safety thing there. There's only four types of train, which means there's going to be more of each type, which means and less rusting intervals, if I can kind of call it that.
Yeah.
Are there any four types? There's the 2, there's the 3-5, there's the brown one and a gray one. Is that right?
I think so. I'm not sure.
I think there are only four types. Yeah, because there's four phases, and I think each train, because you have the different types that you can flip them over.
Yes.
Or whatever, yeah.
So it might either be a 4 or a 3/5 kind of.
Right. But then if you look at something like 1849, there are, I can't remember how many different types of trains, but there's a lot.
Mm.
There was one jump, but there's only one of that train.
Yeah, one of that type, yeah.
And each time you move through those jumps, you have to be rusting previous trains, essentially. Yes. So 1849 has pretty fast trains.
Right. More steps, yeah.
Yeah, more steps means that your trains are going to be rusting more often.
Mm.
And you're going to burn through those faster as well.
Yeah.
So 1849 would be a fast trains game. I think that's something strategically is very, very important to note, especially in terms of things like managing your treasury, managing your access to capital.
Yeah.
If you know the trains are going to be going bankrupt, it basically means you've lost. Mm. There's very rare exceptions to that, but essentially, if you're going bankrupt, you've lost, right?
Yes.
So that needs to now be a priority. If you look at fast trains and it's got the mandatory train buying rule, so you know this is sort of like an entrepreneurial game, as Dave would describe it, and you on the hook for liabilities, then you see that many trains, or you hear that this game has a reputation for a fast train rush, like 18 mechs. I know very little about that game, but I know it has a brutal train rush because that's what everyone says about it. You know something like that, you need to know going in, I need to manage my finances appropriately. I need to not float three companies as fast as possible and have my assets spread around across all of them.
Mm.
Unless you can use it to sort of effectively juggle your trains, but you have to not spread yourself too thin.
Right, yeah.
Essentially. And you have to be very careful with how you're financing your company, how you're managing those finances, how much you're taking out of the treasury, all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So that's something that, in my mind, strategically can be very helpful to look at this and say, is this a fast train game or a slow train game?
Yes.
So the next one is low versus high income, which is sort of how much access to money that you have.
Okay. For running routes, the income you mean? Or
I think broadly in terms of the context of the entire game, how much access to capital you have. So how much are you getting from dividends? How much access to money coming in?
Okay, so that could full cap versus partial cap could also fall into there, I guess, then.
Yeah, I think it depends on how they kind of run. Yeah, okay. So but this surprisingly may surprise you. So 1849 is a very obviously low income game. So that game, I say obviously because if you've played it, it's got these brutal terrain costs, it's got a lot going on in terms of having to— we just spoke about the fast trains. That's definitely a liability, but the track laying, stuff like that, having to partial cap funnel money in, but you'll feel when you play it, it comes in pretty slowly.
Yeah.
So that one, I feel like, is often referred to as kind of a cash poor game. It's a fairly obvious kind of thing. But one of the examples JC uses as a low income game is 1830.
Okay.
He says a notoriously low income game. Which kind of surprised me on first glance, but then the more I kind of thought about it in our plays, I've actually felt that very slow startup, especially in terms of running routes. Your early routes aren't particularly lucrative. There's a lot of building of your network you have to do. There's pretty brutal cutoffs and things like that you can do. So yeah, my experience of actually playing it is that, yeah, actually getting access to money isn't necessarily always that easy.
Yeah.
And the money coming in is not great. And because that's full cap, what that essentially means in the context of 1830 is that you have to float another company and get access to that free money in order to bail out your other companies.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's because it's low income.
Right.
If you compare that to something like 1846, where you don't really have to do that. You don't have to finance a second company to help out your first company. Your first company just kind of gets money and it seems to work out most of the time.
Yeah.
And that's partly because of the slow trains and stuff like that. But you don't get put under a lot of pressure and you generally have free access to money. Or I find in 46. You're not struggling that much. I feel like Cologne is a little bit like that as well in terms of the money. I feel like that's not a particularly cash poor game a lot of the time.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you've got stuff like the bonds and things that you can sort of invest money into and get a free flow of income. You've got the miners that you start off with that go for relatively cheap, that bring income unless it goes horribly wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I felt like Cologne was also a relatively high income game, but I feel like I might have to play it again with fresh eyes to have a clear opinion on that. But just in my memories of playing it,
right, yeah,
it felt more like there was a decent amount of income.
Yes.
Another one was the importance of tiles. So how crucial are the tiles in the game, right?
Like how scarce are they?
How scarce like are they, that? I think, is the biggest and easiest one. 1830 is a good example of that. So it's just extremely scarce. If you look at sort of the fact that there's only one type of city tile, they only go straight. Something like that is something that you need to consider. So we spoke about this in our tile episode, but something you can kind of evaluate early on, like how many tiles are there? How many tricky tile areas are there? I think Marflow is one where that's pretty big.
Okay.
A lot of the Marflow games we've played have had these sort of like intersections with very specific tiles that react in very, very specific ways. And I think that's something that you need to be kind of aware of. How important are these tiles? And I think especially from a strategic standpoint, you can kind of pick that up at the beginning of the game.
Yes.
How much do I need to be focusing on preserving tiles, planning these tiles? I mean, that's in general, you should be doing that anyway. But you can certainly look at this and think, okay, these are the key choke points. These are the key areas. Yeah. Or is this just kind of a free for all?
Right. Yeah.
Also, in terms of what companies you want to float, in terms of what tiles you may have access to.
Yes.
Even at the bare minimum, when we played that 1830 game, someone floated a company and they literally couldn't start it because they couldn't lay the first city tile.
Yes, yeah.
If you are at the beginning of the game aware that that is actually a possibility, it's something you're going to look for when you're looking at floating companies, because that's something you can easily take for granted. Yeah, sure, you float a company, whatever.
Yeah,
just lay a tile, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, first step, step one. The next one was stock appreciation versus dividends. So how much of your final income is going to come from stock and how much is going to come from dividends? Which is more important? Which do you want to focus on more?
Okay.
So a good example of a stock appreciation game would be 1830, where a huge percentage of your value at the end of the game is going to come from your stock. And I think that's largely because it takes quite a long time for roots to cycle up. I've also found that even in the end game, you can easily get stuck out of places.
Mm.
And there's not that many people are necessarily running great routes for great dividends. Yeah. There's a lot of brutal map stuff happening in 1830. But from the beginning, when people are running their routes for 30 and whatever, that stock token keeps going up, keeps going up, keeps going up.
Yeah. And something that I haven't done that could be a factor there as well is how the different stock grids compare to each other. Like in some games, the jumps between increasing your stock value might be higher than in other games. Like we've seen in some games that towards the end of the stock grid, the jumps are big, like maybe 20 or something like that, $20 per jump. Whereas in other games, they might just stay at closer to $5 or $10 or something like that. So yeah, that's something I haven't really done, is to compare those grids, but that could be something to look out for.
Definitely. And if you can kind of identify, especially if you just see it expressed somewhere, these are the kind of little tidbits you can pick up strategically when you play a game for the first time or before you even play it. Just sort of general sentiment on the internet. Like, oh yeah, 1830, most of the score comes from your stock or whatever. You kind of see that and it can help you strategically to identify what you kind of want to be investing into. Are you going for the companies that are going to get bigger jumps towards the end? Like you say, you know, if the grid is, instead of moving up by 10, it's moving up by 30.
Yes.
Towards the end, then you might want to invest in those companies more than the one that could potentially run good routes or potentially have good dividends.
Right.
Also in terms of where you want to shift your focus to. Do you want to get out of this company that has a good stock price right now, but you can get into a company that's going to pay better dividends? Where do you want to shift your priorities to?
Yeah. Something else to look out for is some games have bonuses for running certain routes, like 46 has an east to west bonus. So that could be push more focus towards running profitable routes and paying bigger dividends. Other one we've played was one that had those coal bonuses.
Rhineland,
right. That has those coal bonuses. So that's also something that pushes up the dividend.
Yeah, absolutely. And that can push a dividend into range where it's outpacing stock appreciation. Which is something to look out for as well. And then certificate limits. How brutal do those feel? How tight or constrained do they feel? This is something you may only be able to kind of get after your first play. I think it depends on what the certificate limit is. If it's very low, you may sort of think, okay, this is going to be a big factor. But some games, the example used in this post was 46, in that you can frequently win a game of 46 without being at the certificate limit.
Okay.
Because of how big those stock jumps can kind of be well. And the fact that it's not necessarily about owning the most shares. It's about having the best performing shares.
Right.
Yeah. So I think 46 is a good example of that. But you need to get a feel for whether or not certificate limit is a huge factor here. So are you trying to just amass as many shares as possible because they're fairly close in value a lot of the time? Or are you trying to identify what are the best shares and own those? So that can be hugely important in 46, right? Because in 46, your stock price movement actually depends largely on what dividends you're paying.
Yes.
There's that threshold system where you can do triple jumps if you pay triple your current stock price.
Right.
So it's not just about steadily moving up. Whereas in something like 1830, where it's a fairly static movement, that doesn't really make sense, but it's a fairly sedate kind of movement.
Or linear, right? Or something
else. Yeah, where you sort of move one at a time.
One step at a time.
And a lot of companies, in 1830, you kind of never really want to withhold. You want to use future companies to fund your previous companies. So the stocks are generally all going to be moving up at a similar pace most of the time. That means that essentially what you really want is just to own the most shares.
Right.
rather than necessarily the best shares.
Yes.
Whereas in 46, you could definitely sacrifice the number of shares you have in order to have the best shares.
Mm, yeah.
So you could go from 11 to 9 certificates or whatever, and it would be worth it if you were trading up for better shares.
Right, yeah.
That's not necessarily true in a lot of games.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the last thing is just liabilities. That's something that's less of a factor depending on what game you're playing, but most games have pretty significant liabilities, and those liabilities are almost always the requirement to own a train. But important to note that some games do not have that. Like I said, 1860. So you have to sort of keep that in mind. If that's not a liability, I feel like I haven't played 1860, but you should be able to potentially take more risks to spread yourself more thinly, to be less concerned about that kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, I guess it depends entirely on what the financial implications are for you.
Yes. Yeah.
But certainly it changes your approach to the game, because you are not out of the game if you screw that up.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of the line. If you're out of the game when you screw up your liabilities, it makes it a lot more high stakes.
Yes.
Essentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those were, so like I said, I found this stuff in a thread that was kind of all around how to classify games into different groups. But I was thinking in terms of that classification that there could be a strategic advantage to sort of identifying what are the key points of these games.
Yeah, what you should be paying attention to and focusing on.
Yeah, and I like Dave's idea of identifying what you as a player, what your role is in the game.
Yes, yeah.
As well, because that's
what,
also...
What will you get rewarded for, basically?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. 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 That's essentially what it comes down to.
Yeah,
so I hope that kind of makes sense. Yeah, so I just wanted to briefly go through each of those things and how it could potentially affect your strategy. I think some more so than others.
Yes.
I think especially if you're new, I want to say the most important ones are probably how fast the trains are. I think that's probably potentially even the biggest one. Because again, anything that influences bankruptcy is pretty large.
Yeah.
Because yeah, if you bankrupt, you're out most of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how fast the trains are. The importance of the tiles, I think, again, going back to the other episode that we did on that, hugely important to identify what the key points there are. Yeah, and I like this idea of, I guess I want to say stock appreciation versus dividends and best shares versus most shares. I think the intersection of those two things is probably fairly important as well. But I think that's an important thing. Essentially, always in 18xx games, right, you're trying to evaluate your best bang for buck, how to get the most return on your money. That's always what you're trying to do.
Right.
And essentially that's what that comes down to.
Yes.
Am I trying to sort of get the maximum dividends from these routes that I can, or am I trying to crawl my shares continuously up?
Yes. Yeah.
That can influence a lot of things. Is it worth withholding to buy a better train? Or is it way more important that I just continue to climb that share price without losing those two jumps that I'd get from a withhold?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah, interesting.
Important to keep that stuff in mind. So essentially the idea of this is when you sit down at the table, try and identify these key points and figure out going in where strategically you want to be or what you want to be trying to do. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Cool, yeah, it does, yeah. I think okay. It's useful, yeah.
Cool. Anything else we wanted to chat about?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, cool. So... Oh, a South African thing. So I'll keep this one brief this week. But I was thinking about this because we are currently in the Rugby World Cup.
Yes.
So for some people, this is a total non-event. Probably for a lot of the American listeners. Sweden, certainly, I don't think has any cares for rugby. But yeah, there are certain rugby playing nations in the world. So it's basically, what are the big nations, right? It's the UK, that whole kind of area. So New Ireland Zealand, and the UK, and then Australia, New Zealand. Some of South America, Japan now.
Yeah.
That's where the World Cup's being hosted.
Yes.
Previously not really a thing in Asia, but Japan has sort of done very well. And then us, essentially, yeah, some African teams as well. And Russia was in there too.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so not a huge thing, but that's happening right now. So we beat Japan on Sunday. Yeah, which was great for us. Kind of sad to see them go because they're the home team.
Yes, but they played well, I think.
Well, they had an incredible run. Japan used to be kind of a joke of a team. They were really, really bad. And then what happened at the last World Cup was they got this huge win against us actually. I think it was like the opening game or something, or one of the first games. And it was just a huge shock.
Mm.
And that was Japan sort of re-entering the world of rugby and saying, hey, what's up?
Yes,
we can here. Actually play now. Yeah. That was a massive, massive shock. They had another huge win in this World Cup. They beat Ireland.
Oh, right.
In the group stages. Ireland was the number one ranked team in the world coming into the World Cup.
Wow.
So Japan beating them was pretty massive as well.
Mm.
And Japan ended up topping their group, which is why we played Japan in the quarterfinals, even though we came second in our group. Because we played the first seed in the other one. So it was a good break for us because Japan is not the strongest team in spite of pulling off some amazing wins. Yeah, so anyway, what I wanted to mention was every time we had the World Cup, we sing our national anthem.
Yes.
So as I think is the case in most of these sporting, big sporting events, the teams will sing their national anthems. And what's interesting about ours is that it's actually in four different languages.
Yes.
Which I think is quite cool. So our first sort of verse is in Xhosa, which is a language that's spoken sort of in the Eastern and Western Cape primarily. So sort of the south of South Africa, the bottom south coast there.
Yeah.
And west coast. And then the second language is Zulu, which is sort of spoken on the east coast and through a lot of South Africa. It's a pretty widespread language.
Right.
Zulu, I believe, being the biggest indigenous tribe that we had. So we have Zulu all over the country, essentially. Yes. But originated sort of on the east coast there. And then third verse is Fred's. So that's Afrikaans.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's sort of the, I don't know how you describe it. We've spoken about Afrikaans before, I guess. Yes. Sort of a local language that was sort of developed as part of Dutch, from essentially. Dutch and,
yeah.
And then the last verse being in English,
yes,
which is spoken by the majority of the country.
Yeah, not necessarily as a first language, but
yeah,
most people in South Africa.
Yes, yeah. It's sort of our kind of universal language here. Yeah. So even people from different African backgrounds will tend to speak to each other in English if they don't have a shared language. That's most of the time what they'll be using.
Yes.
Yeah. All our entertainment and stuff like that is mostly in English as well. And if it's not, it'll have English subtitles. So
yes.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So I just thought that was a cool kind of thing. I don't know how many countries there are like that, actually, that have an anthem in multiple languages. I don't know if that's unique to us.
I don't know. That's an interesting question. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Because there's certainly other sort of cosmopolitan countries around the world. It'd be interesting, actually. I wonder how many others there are.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But I thought that's kind of a cool little fact about our national anthem.
Yeah. Very cool.
Cool. Anyway, thanks very much, guys.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Chat soon.
Cheers.
Cheers.
If you would like to get in touch with us, we are at derailed18xx on Instagram and Twitter. You can email us, derailed18xx@gmail.com, and we're on Patreon at patreon.com/derailed18xx. Thanks for listening.